Well, lots going on in the skies these days. And in fact, there's some big events, or one big event coming up within the next couple of weeks. And thought we'd talk about that and about what's going on in astronomy with Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. He's a faculty associate in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Space Place is located in Madison on South Park Street, 2300 South Park Street in the Villager Mall. We're really pleased to have him with us as his sidekick, Tom Hall. We're glad to have him, too. Tom's an optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. So if you have questions about the skies, if you have questions about optics, I hope you will join in. Here's the number to call. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. 263-1890, and you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Jim Lattice, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Good morning.
And Tom Hall, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you here.
Good morning, Larry.
We're arriving at that time of the year for the Perseid meteor shower.
Yeah, Perseid meteor shower. People look forward to that, you know, because they go on their camping trips or whatever they're doing outdoors this time of year, and you get to see a few nice meteors, really, most of the night, although we always say that the best hours for meteor observing are the midnight to dawn hours, and actually this year that's going to be quite true because the moon will interfere until it sets, which I think is around a little after 1 a.m. or something in that neighborhood, depending on your horizon and that sort of thing. But if you don't have the moon, then you'll see some nice meteors. Sometimes we even see them in the evening hours. The Perseids is a pretty reliable shower, so we're looking for that. The peak the Perseids will be on the morning of the 12th. Although mm-hmm. we also always say not to, it's not something to set your watch by. The peak is a broad peak, and there's meteor activity for days before and days after a word from the peak.
Well, we have some visitors coming from Trinidad to stay with us, and they're arriving on the evening of the 12th, so it'll probably be a late night for us anyway when they welcome them in when they get here.
And, well, and you know, that's a northern shower too, so they won't have seen that from southern regions, that shower is less and less favorable as it goes farther south. So it'd be something of a treat then.
So, well, I probably know what I'll be doing at midnight or 1 o'clock on the 12th. Then, taking a look out in the sky. Where do they come? You know, how does this happen every year? Explain that.
Sure. Actually, it's this is kind of a fun thing. It was only really figured out in the late 19th century that there's a connection between meteors, those streaks of light that we see in the sky. People call them falling stars or shooting stars, you know, colloquially. That there's a connection between those and comets, which people have also seen for centuries. But the connection between the two wasn't really understood. This particular meteor shower that is called the Perseids because of the constellation that they're associated with, although you also don't have to be able to find Perseus in the sky to watch for the meteors. The comet is called Swift-Tuttle, after two astronomers who discovered it. And we get the meteor shower when we cross the comet's orbit. There's a point in space where the Earth's orbit and the comet's orbit more or less intersect. And we reach that point, since it's in our orbit, we reach that same point every year at about the same time.
And that's why we see it.
So, yeah. So we cross the comet's orbit. We run into a bunch of little fragments that the comet has left in its orbit on previous passes through the inner solar system. And those are the particles that burn up in our atmosphere and that we see in the shower.
Well, callers online to visit with you guys. Mark in Lake Delton, I believe, is up first. So let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm just my wife threw out there the other night that she would like a telescope for Christmas. So I'm thinking, like, I'd like to get away for under $400 if possible. If you've got any recommendations, brand names, I don't really think we need anything that's going to be computer tracking. That might be a little bit sophisticated, you know, kind of an entry level unit. Mm-hmm. Any recommendations?
All right. Well, let's turn to Tom Hall first for that. Tom.
Sure. And we'd have a couple of questions for you on some preferences. Is this something that you're hoping to be somewhat portable with? I mean, do you have to take it out camping with you, or would you mind getting one of the larger tube designs, the Dobsonian designs, that can be a little bulkier but would definitely fit within your price range.
Well, I'm thinking we're going to leave it at home. Why? You know, it's probably going to stay home with us.
I can certainly recommend a few of the less expensive Dobsonians. You could get an 8-inch aperture telescope, sometimes even larger, if you do your shopping right, within that price range. Orion Telescopes, in particular, out of California, has some excellent entry-level equipment that you won't have to assemble yourself, other than, you know, getting it going out of the box. There are certainly kits that you can get into, but I guess I'm not going to recommend that from where you're coming from here. That requires a little more effort than you might want to get into just to start out and get interested in the field.
Okay, and the brand name again was?
Orion Telescopes.
Orion. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
They have a great website. You can look over their equipment and get a feel for the size of the, you know, telescope itself and figure out where you might be able to store them. But scopes of this caliber, they'll store well even in a garage. They can be somewhat impervious to temperature changes, so you don't have to store them in the house necessarily. They'll give you some good options.
Great.
Most important thing is to keep it clean. Put like a shower cap or something over the end of it when you're not using it to keep the spiders and the dust out of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. And Yvonne in Appleton, you are next. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to be in Japan August 12th visiting my daughter, and I'm wondering if the meteor shower will be visible there.
Ah, what about that, Jim?
Good question, and no doubt the meteor shower, weather permitting, obviously.
Right.
So the conditions will really be about the same as here. Depending, unless you're in far southern Japan.
No.
Do you know what happened? Know the latitude of the place you're?
I don't
going?
Know the latitude. It's slightly south of Wisconsin. I'm thinking it's probably latitude similar to like Kentucky.
Oh, all right. Well, that should be fine. Yeah. The only if you go far enough south, this is why Larry's Trinidad visitors might not have seen this very well. If you go far enough south, then Perseus, which is a northern constellation, remains pretty low on the horizon most of the time. But as far north as really continental U.S. easily, it gets high enough in the sky that you'll see considerable activity. So, yeah, and that won't affect the timing. That pretty much just local time is what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So the local time there in Japan, just past midnight, between midnight and dawn local time.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Sure. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Leonard Susskind's book, The Black Hole War, My Battle with Stephen Hawking to Make the World Safe for Quantum Physics. Not a book that I would be reading. Well, it might be one if I was having trouble sleeping.
Well, have you tried?
It's not apparently not easy summer reading.
I haven't seen it, but it sounds intriguing, doesn't it? You know, that's a huge battlefield these days in physics, the meeting point between gravitational theory, as Einstein worked it out for us in general relativity, and quantum mechanics, as it was worked out really at about the same time by people like Bohr and Heisenberg and that crowd, and the early both of these things developing in the early part of the 20th century, we're still looking for the meeting point between those two theories. Because there's no quantum theory of gravity, it makes it very hard for us to figure out, we have no way to figure out, what's happening at very small scales when quantum forces are very large, which means black holes, basically.
Yeah.
At least that's the main application for this kind of thing. And so, yeah, Stephen Hawking has some views on that a lot of people in the field have found to be at least stimulating and influential, and a lot of people think are right, although these are all still things that are very, very hard to test, of course. So, but that's going to be that area is, I would hazard to say, maybe the most exciting area of research these days for physicists to engage in it, because it's the last place where the fundamental forces of nature that interface between quantum mechanics and gravitational theory, where it's really uncharted. Mm. And string theory comes in there too, which is where a lot of the excitement comes from, a lot of the debate.
Well, what black holes, somebody's asked me, what are black holes? What are black holes?
A black hole is a region in space where enough mass has been concentrated, and there are ways that this happens, where enough mass has been concentrated that no light or anything else can escape from that point in space. The gravitational field is so strong that even light can't escape from it, which means it can't communicate with the rest of the universe. So the typical black holes that are out there in the universe arise, and we've confirmed the existence of a number of these from the outside. And what happens inside a black hole is this gets us into this quantum gravitation that we don't have, that physics that we don't have yet. But from outside, if a star collapses, a star that's big enough collapses, then its core becomes dense enough that light cannot escape from it, and it withdraws from the universe in a lot of ways. As seen from outside, it's a place where you can enter, but you can never get out of, hence the black hole. No light comes out of the black hole. If you fall into the black hole, you never get back out, because that gravitational field is stronger than any force that you can exert to get out of there. So these form in the cores of stars when stars explode, and then they can coalesce. Black holes can absorb other matter, can fall into the black holes, and black holes can merge. And we now know that in the centers of, very commonly, people are starting to say most galaxies, there are black holes that are millions of times the mass of the sun, that are probably going to turn out to be really important in how galaxies develop. And this was 10, 15 years ago, this was an element in the behavior of galaxies that wasn't even suspected. So black holes are out there, and they're a big part of the universe, actually.
Michael in New Berlin has a question for you guys. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question. There is kind of a locally famous landmark in Wisconsin at the 4590 mark. There's actually a 4590 astronomy club that works out there. I don't know if anybody's ever noticed, but we drove by it the other day, and it says geological marker rather than geographical marker when you actually look at the monument they put out.
Sorry, I don't know this one. Does it have a name?
It's just known as the 4590 point on the planet. It's I think it's near Punatuski, a small town, and someone put up a monument. And there's a 4590 astronomy club that's out there, because it's very easy to set up your tracking of stars because of where you are on the planet.
So it's 45 degrees north and 90 degrees east, or west, rather.
Yeah.
So that's the latitude and the longitude. So that's where the latitude and longitude numbers are even.
Yeah, it's one of the corners of the planet, sort of based on Greenwich Mean.
Got
it. And where is it located?
I think the little city of Punatuski. It's out in the middle of like a farmer's field.
In what state? Here in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin, yes.
Gotcha.
All right. So it's going to be north and about the same longitude. Madison's at 89 and a little bit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a little bit west of us and then a couple degrees north.
Right. It's basically be almost due north of Madison, one degree off.
So there's a marker there to indicate the point. It'd be fun to take your GPS unit out there and see if they got it right.
Well, GPS could be off by 30 or 40 feet, I guess, but still.
Well, yeah.
It's just kind of interesting, but when you actually look at it, all the little signs say geographic, but when you get to the actual sign, there's a typo on it saying geological.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll talk some more about that with our two guests, Jim Lattice and Tom Hall, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking astronomy now with Jim Lattice of the UW-Madison Space Place and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. Really glad to have them along. And certainly if you have questions about the optics or about the stars, give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And just before the news, we were talking about 4590, that concept, Jim Lattice. And what are we talking about here?
That must be the coordinates, the latitude and the longitude, respectively, of this point, which makes sense that it would fall in Wisconsin. Latitude is the distance measured from the angular distance measured from the Earth's equator up to the pole, 90 degrees at the Earth's pole, mm-hmm. zero at the equator. Madison is a little more than 43 degrees. 45 degrees would be, of course, half of 90, so that's halfway from the pole to the equator. The longitude we measure from an arbitrary point. The pole and the equator are naturally sort of define themselves. The longitude is measured from the prime meridian in England, which is an arbitrarily defined point. There used to be various prime meridians, but we all agree pretty much now to use the one in England. And so you measure degrees... east or west of that line. And so, again, Madison is a little over 89 degrees, or about, you know, a right angle, 90 degrees, one-fourth of the way around. So the 90-degree point, the 45-90 point, apparently falls in Wisconsin and has a mark, which was news to me.
And I'm not sure what the significance of that mark would be, 45-90, probably.
Well, people like even numbers, right? It's like we all had a big party in the year 2000, too, because it was the odometer effect.
Gotcha. John in Menominee, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I've got an old telescope, an old reflecting telescope with a 10-inch mirror, and that mirror is getting very cloudy and kind of dull-looking, and I'm wondering, what do you advise? Is there an easy way to get it replated, or what do you think?
Tom?
Well, you can replate mirrors. There's several facilities throughout the country that still do it, one of which is in Chicago. But first, you might be surprised, and it won't harm anything in doing so. You should try a good cleaning on it first, and seeing if the underlying structure is, you know, sound enough to get you a good image. And that's relatively easy. There's just a couple of steps you want to keep in mind while you're doing them. You don't want to use standard tap water. What you'd like to do is go out and buy a few gallons of distilled water at the grocery store.
Okay.
So just use distilled water on it, and then you won't be evaporating minerals onto the surface of the mirror itself.
Okay.
The mirrors themselves are front surfaced. They're not like your bathroom mirrors. So the silvering is actually right on that surface that you're going to be working on. So you have to be very gentle. You'll want to get some sort of cotton balls. Almost all cotton balls will be surgical cotton, they call it, which are relatively free of impurities.
Okay.
So you can stroke them gently across the mirror after you've submerged it in something. So if you've got a 10-inch mirror, you're going to have to find a fair-sized tub of something to put it in, and you'll want it to be relatively clean, too. You know, find a nice, clean Rubbermaid tub that you haven't used for other stuff or that sort of thing. Get it submerged under the water first. You can use one or two drops of ivory liquid or rubbing alcohols. Those should not affect the mirror surface, the silvering itself either.
Okay.
Mirrors of this style are generally aluminum, not silver. You know, they aluminize the mirrors. There are some other materials that they use, and the one in Chicago does use a different surface, as I recall. But any web search would turn them up for you. Just look for, you know, mirror resilvering or telescope mirror refinishing, and they'll pull up a few names for you. But I would try the cleaning of it first.
Okay.
Again, you draw the cotton gently across the surface after you've got it submerged.
Uh-huh. Under the water you do it?
Yeah, do it right under the water.
Okay.
And then after you pull it up out of the water, you can have a spare gallon jug of the distilled water free. Tip the mirror gently on its side, and with a 10-inch, you might want an assistant with you to kind of hold the edges, and then rinse it sideways and let distilled water dribble over the mirror surface itself and run off, and then just let it air dry. You might be surprised the results you get, that it'll look fairly good. Slight imperfections or places where you don't get all of the dust or grit or, you know, cigarette smoke, whatever it was, whatever it was succumbed to over the years, you can leave some of that on and still get a surprisingly good image.
Okay. And now how about the little secondary mirror? Should I try the same thing on that? Or?
Yep. You can use the same methods on that. Although, you know, if you haven't aligned a secondary mirror much or if you've never worked on it, I almost recommend you leave it in the scope and try a damp cotton ball over the surface of that, because getting that realigned will be much worse than trying to realign the main mirror.
Oh, I'm not going to touch it.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Kay in Madison, your turn next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I was up at the Extreme Makeover House in Richland Center.
Yes.
And I thought you would be interested to know that they have, as part of the house, they have a viewing tower that looks like a silo.
Yes.
And they're going to have a telescope that viewing tower.
I had noticed they were building a round tower to the side of it. I wondered if it was an architectural detail to...
That's what someone that knows the family said, apparently that's an interest of the family, so it would be a wonderful place out in the middle of the country.
Oh, that would be great. My
to
father-in-law.
View the stars.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, just to view the stars, it would be a wonderful place.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
My father-in-law lives just north of there in Boaz, Wisconsin, and it is dark. Richland Center is fairly close, but it's kind of off to the north. And the hills in that area, you're in the Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin, shield a lot of the light from some of the small towns. And boy, it would be an excellent viewing area.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming. It's my wife's favorite television program, as a matter of fact. So I don't know if I dare tell. Well, yeah, I'll have to tell her that. She wanted to go and volunteer, but she found out about it too late. So she wasn't able to do that. Well, that's a totally another topic. Thank you very much, Kay, for calling. I guess I will tell her. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we talk optics and the skies with our guests Jim Lattice and Tom Hall. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And you know, you're talking about light, and somebody was telling me it's about two-thirds of the world's population, including most everyone in the continental U.S. and Europe, no longer see a starry sky where they live. Jim?
That doesn't surprise me a bit. It's easy. If you live in a big city, Chicago, New York, or something like that, it's very easy to go out at night and there's just this a glow. Only the brightest objects, you might see Jupiter or a couple of bright stars or something. But it's hard to find a sky that's not light polluted to some extent. And it's very easy to find yourself in a place where the sky is so bright that you can't see the Milky Way, that you can't see even stars. People might imagine they ought to be able to see the Big Dipper, but four of the seven stars in the Little Dipper, I meant to say, people are familiar with that constellation, yeah. But four of the seven stars there are almost impossible to see from Madison. The sky is actually brighter than those stars. So you can look up there and find some of the stars in the Little Dipper, but not all of the stars in the Little Dipper. So it really is an issue that I think people are becoming more aware of. There's the International Dark Sky Association, and there's an increasing talk about, especially from the energy conservation angle, about light pollution abatement, because a lot of it has to do with making better use of the light that you've got available and actually shining it in the direction where you need it rather than just sort of letting it spread everywhere, which is a big part of the problem.
Yeah. Bob in De Pere has a question for you guys. Bob, hello.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Good. My wife purchased a magazine on photography and had an article on astrophotography in it. And I'm wondering what kind of equipment you could recommend for someone who's interested in getting started in that from their backyard.
Well, the most basic equipment is a standard 35-millimeter camera itself. And you can make yourself, or you can use some fairly simple platforms that will allow you to take wide field pictures of, you know, astronomical fields, just the stars that you can see. And again, you should be out in pretty dark skies to try to generate some of those. If you're looking for equipment in the telescopes that will allow you to attach camera platforms, either new electronic cameras or CCD cameras that have been sold in the astronomical community for many years, or even still 35 millimeter with the film or with the slide films, those get, I'm going to say, really relatively expensive if you're going to use them to get good images. The problem is that you need extremely accurate tracking motors to move these higher magnifications, a much smaller star field, if you will, so that the stars themselves won't streak. So you're realistically looking at, I'm going to say, $1,500 to $2,000 worth of accurately tracked telescope to start getting good images. Now, it's true. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's kind of what I thought when I was looking through the catalog and I saw some of the starting prices, and I thought, ooh, this is a little more expensive than just, say, using my standard 35-millimeter camera and hooking it up to a telescope.
It certainly is. Now, if you want to do some work, and if you want to try to find some used equipment, you can probably find some used Newtonian telescopes, either from Meade or Celestron, and they can be 15 or 20 years old even. Don't shy away from them just because they're older equipment, that may have very accurate motor drives that run off 110 volts. It's not very common in the industry these days. Most of them are battery-powered. And therefore computer-controlled, and some of them won't even have to use the 45-degree angle that we were kind of discussing here earlier, wedges, to make sure that the telescope tube tracks at the proper angle. These you would have a little more setup to do. You'd be working with used equipment, but you can probably find some really fine pieces that could get you some good results with film cameras for around $500 to $700 in the used market. But there you've got a bit more of a search. You'd want to go to some of your local clubs and use some of their resources. Madison Astronomical Society, for instance, in particular, and I'm sure you'd find some up north. There's a great one in Green Bay, for instance.
Milwaukee Astronomical Society.
Milwaukee Astronomical
is a big
Society.
One. Mm-hmm.
All of these are people who would love to have newcomers come in and learn astrophotography, as it's something of a dying art. If you want to get into it, you'd certainly have some resources and some people in the clubs that could get you started.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Doug in Mauston next. Doug, hello to you.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Last night, about 10 o'clock, I was headed home traveling east from Mauston, and I noticed 3 to 4 bright yellow flashes in the sky. They were coming out. They didn't really descend. They came out more horizontally, and it appeared as though they were coming from the east headed towards the west. And I was wondering if you guys had any idea what those maybe were. And if I see something like that and you don't happen to be on the radio the next day, where could I look on the Internet to find out some information on something like that?
These were objects. Do these things track across the sky, or were they bright flashes in the sky that you saw?
They did track across the sky. They were yellowish in color.
You saw them all at the same time?
No, it was one would come and it would flare out, and it lasted probably about 10, 15 seconds, and then another one right behind it. And like I said, there was one caught my eye, and I vaguely counted about 3 or 4 of them.
Well, that's a lot of them. That's unusual to have them that close together. There's a couple of possibilities. I don't know right off what you saw, but there's a couple of ways to investigate. Likely explanations are that you saw some sort of satellite phenomenon. And there are some good ways to check into that that are pretty easy. For example, you might have seen a series of iridium flashes. And those are reflections of the sun from satellites that have very large solar panels and reflect sunlight very effectively. And you can get a nice glint of sunlight from them for a very brief time.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been it. These were more like flare-ups.
Well, that's what an iridium flare looks like. It looks like a flare is there for just a few seconds, and then
They did trail down though. They curved. There was a curvature to the flare. It almost looked like large yellowish red flames.
I see. Well, you might have also seen a satellite re-entering and disintegrating. I didn't hear about any particular big ones, but the fact that you saw several fairly close together could have been fragments from the same satellite. The place to go probably is a website that I like to recommend called Heavens Above, heavensabove.com. That's heavens-above.com.
Okay.
And you can go there, and it's very easy to give them your location. And then there are a number of options there for tracking iridium flares and satellites, and they might track re-entering satellites. I don't remember.
I believe they do, and yeah. I think they also have a history function. You don't have to enter, just dates from today onward.
No, you're
right. You can backtrack dating on it.
You can.
Okay.
So that's heavens-above?
Heavens-above.com.
The other thing that piqued my interest, too, is I saw the little white blips of a fighter jet cruising across at fairly high altitude, right directly towards those flares after they had come into the atmosphere. So it was kind of strange.
Yeah,
but we see a lot of the fighter jets up this way because of the bombing range.
Yeah, well, if that was a military exercise and that could explain an awful lot of things, then you probably won't find it on Heavens Above.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Doug.
Thanks so much, guys.
Appreciate it. Steele and Nina, your turn. Hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Hey, just to comment on metropolitan areas and how we lose the skies above some major cities when they've had power outages, people would be calling the police and the fire department and commenting on a white line in the sky, which was actually the Milky Way. And I go a little west of Appleton, 10 miles, so just with a couple glows of minor city, so it should be nice. I hope it's cloud-free for the Perseids, for everybody.
Yeah.
Anyway, just an interesting comment on how we get alienated in our own universe.
Thank you, Steele.
Yeah, quite right. I like to call it sky consciousness, which is definitely decreasing a lot these days, and people aren't familiar with. I had a call one time from a very sincere woman who was noticed the moon out her window, and a little bit later it was lower, and a little bit later it was still lower, and she found this worrisome. And called up, and I said, no, that's perfectly natural, as long as you're looking west. It's just setting. But people didn't realize that this is a normal sort of thing. And I think there's a lot of sky phenomena that are unfamiliar to people now because we spend so little time under it.
Angela in Madison, your turn. Hi, Angela.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is more along the lines of telescoping 101. So my husband and I have a telescope in a place we have in northern Wisconsin outside of Hayward. But we've not really done much with it. And I guess I'm trying to figure out where a good starting point is. Is it to become familiar, for example, with the Big Dipper and what the stars are? Or where would you begin for somebody who's got a telescope and is excited to, begin their foray into the heavens, but where do you begin?
Well, boy, that's a very individual sort of thing. I guess our standard advice, Tom can jump in here too, would be, start by learning some constellations. Take a pair of binoculars outside and use a pair of binoculars to investigate the Milky Way and things like that in the sky that you can appreciate in that dark sky. Depends a lot on the type of telescope, but there are things that make telescopes harder to use sometimes that you need to make sure are in good shape, like that the mounting shouldn't be too wobbly, preferably not wobbly at all, and if it's probably got a little finder telescope on it, you want that to be aligned, and you want to play with your telescope in the daytime. Don't aim it at the sun, but learn to focus it on distant objects, learn how to use the finder to find objects, and practice with that in the daytime when you're not fumbling around in the dark and get comfortable with it that way.
Okay.
And to get a feel of what you might want to look at, UW Space Place, this is what they do. You should see some of the public programs that they have on Tuesdays or Saturdays, and they'll get an impression of some of the larger objects you can pick up in a telescope and what those mean and the background story behind them to keep you interested.
All right.
Talk a little bit more about those Tuesday nights.
Well, we have a range of things that happen at Space Place. The second Tuesday of the month, for example, we have a guest speaker. In fact, we have a guest speaker coming up on, I believe it's August 12th, August 12th at 7 p.m. And we also do a series of programs on Saturday mornings that are our family programs at 10. We do actual sky observing. These days, our schedule is that we open up on the third Friday of the month, and we've combined the talk that I typically give about what's happening in the sky with sky observing itself, if the sky is clear. So we do that on the third Friday, and we set up our telescopes on the roof, and we point out constellations and look at the objects that are available in the sky. And that's a good time to talk about telescopes. We have a lot of people come up and want to know what kind of telescope we're using and how it compares to one they might have or be looking for. And so those are real good opportunities to have that kind of discussion, too. I should also mention that the Madison Astronomical Society, which welcomes visitors at their meeting, meets on the second Friday of each month at about 7:30, I think it is, on at Space Place. And they welcome visitors, too, and that's quite a repository of experience and information there as well.
Fun place to go. And you'll be traveling to the west.
We are doing a trip with the Wisconsin Alumni Association, which we do from time to time. We team up with them. This is actually our third time to tour astronomical sites in Arizona. And that will be, I think it's September 27th until October 4th. So there's actually still time, if anyone is interested in that, to contact the Alumni Association and check into that trip. I believe there's still room on the trip for a few visitors. We go to fascinating places. We get behind-the-scenes tours at University of Arizona and at Kitt Peak National Observatory. We go up to Lowell Observatory. We go to Meteor Crater, and we go by the Grand Canyon along the way. So it's a really great trip, and Arizona's a beautiful, beautiful country, and the skies are fantastic, which is why one of the reasons all that astronomy is out there. So, that's what the Alumni Association, and we'll be doing that coming up soon in the fall.
This year, there are rumors on the internet that in August, Mars will appear as large as a full moon.
Yeah, this year again.
What's the actual situation?
That was a few years back, unfortunately.
I guess it's the age of the internet or something. These seem to be echoes of the 2003 event.
Oh.
And somebody, I don't know if it's somebody or some organization, I don't know what happens, but every year somebody changes the dates from 2003 to 2004 to 2005 and then sends around the same information. So, yes, that's actually going around. I received that email just the other day. And was shocked. We have, if you want to know more about that, we have a link on the Space Place webpage, which is easy to find. It's just spaceplace.org, spaceplace.org. And then if you look at featured astronomical events, that's a big link there. The current featured astronomical event is the one that's not going to happen, which is this Mars as big as the full moon thing that's going around again. So, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Spaceplace.com.
.org.
.org.
.org. Yeah, spaceplace.org.
And for Eagle Optics, Eagle Optics is eagleoptics.com.
That's correct.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for inviting us.
Thank you, Larry.
Jim Lattis, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics in Middleton. Pleasure to have them along. They'll be back again. We'll talk some more. Don't forget those Perseid meteor showers.
August 12th,
the great day to look. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.